Today we're talking about Twin Peaks, The Return, Part 9. And we're going to cover some major clues on Dougie's processing of what's going on in this world. Major Briggs's clue in the chair. The mob zone is confirmed. We've got more rings. We go into theories about Jack Rabbit's palace and more parallels to Twin Peaks' first seasons. I'm your host, Isaac Weishaupt, and you are in the Grey Lodge. Now, this episode gives us more clues than typical. It's almost like Twin Peaks has got something it really wants to tell us, especially since part 8. All right. We're getting a fire hose of clues. Now, the first time I watched season 3, Twin Peaks The Return, I wasn't picking up on none of this, and I just thought, boy, is this a boring show. But when you watch it a couple times and you have an extraordinary guide to walk you through, you'll say, wow, pretty amazing. So without further ado, let's get into this episode. We start out, Mr. C, he's all bloodied and beat up, and he's walking up to a post on a dirt road and retrieves a red bandana. We've confirmed now that the woodsman in part 8 did in fact bring him back to life. There he is. In the flesh. And I don't know if he's gangbanging or what. He's got that red bandana. And Mr. C walks into a farm where, well, actually, the Bloods and the Crips, they would cross out the sea. So Mr. C, that would be a blue bandana, right? I don't know. Anyway, Mr. C walks onto a farm and we see Chantel and Hutch there. They've killed the farmers. And they provide Mr. C with some new clothes and a new phone, some burner phones, right? And we see him send a text to someone that says, around the dinner table, the conversation is lively. Now, this reminds me, for no reason at all, of season 1, episode 3, where we have that long, drawn-out dinner table at the beginning of the episode at the Horn family. Everyone's at the table, Audrey, Ben, and nobody's talking. They're just eating for like 5 minutes. And then Jerry comes storming in with his brie and butter sandwiches. And I thought, is that a reference to this somehow? Maybe it's saying that Jerry's back and the conversation is lively. I don't know. Is Mr. C wanting a brie and butter sandwich? I don't know. It just made me think of it. Maybe that's a clue for later. Mr. C calls that dude in Vegas, demanding he complete something real soon. He then tells Hutch to take out Warden Murphy, and then he's going to get them a double banger in Vegas. Now, the reason Mr. C is mad at Warden Murphy is because he apparently, when he gave him the car with the gun, he set it up so that Ray could kill him, right? Meanwhile, the FBI, they're on a private jet. Colonel Davis from the Pentagon calls Gordon Cole on the satellite phone, telling him, hey, you should head over to Buckhorn and speak with a guy named a person, Lieutenant Knox, spelled capital K, small N, small O, small X. I mean, you gotta love David Lynch, right? You gotta love him or he'll drive you nuts. So Gordon Cole convinces Diane that they're gonna turn the plane around to investigate a Blue Rose case in Buckhorn. Now, Diane's phone shows that the signal is blocked. I was curious about this. I couldn't come to any conclusions. How and why? And I thought, was this related to those trackers from the last episode of Part 8 where Mr. C tosses some trackers out the phone out the window? Or is this just an FBI plane that blocks all signals? I mean, cell phones don't work up that high, I don't think, right? So Warden Murphy, because the presumption here is that Diane has a change of plans and she's trying to text her mystery man on the other side of the phone there and say, hey, we're going back to Buckhorn. So Warden Murphy calls Cole and tells him that Cooper has escaped right? We already know this. Mr. C escaped. Cooper flew the coop. Meanwhile, in Las Vegas, the Dougie and Janie E are at the police station. Detective Fusco is interviewing battling Bud Mullins, the guy who manages the insurance, Lucky 7 Insurance Company. And you hear a lot of clues about Dougie. Bud tells the police that Dougie started working for him 12 years ago, right after he had a car accident. And again, unrelated, free-flowing thoughts. I thought, is this related to Mr. C's car accident that we saw in, I think it was episode 1 or 2? But that wouldn't have been 12 years ago, right? And if we know it's 25 years after the season 2 finale, 1989 plus 25 years takes us to 2014. 12 years prior is 2002. Does any of this matter? I have no idea. And when you research all of this and try to get to the bottom of it, none of the dates really match up. So I don't know if that's relevant to the story or just honest sort of continuity errors. Regardless, Bud Mullins heads out of the detective office, and one of the detectives tells Fusco, like, hey, I looked into it. There's no records of this Dougie Jones guy prior to 1997. Which, again, the date doesn't really add up. That's not 12 years prior to the current time frame, but whatever. There's no driver's license. There's no passport. There's no social security number. There's no birth certificate. There's no tax records. And they think this guy's in witness protection. And they think, well, let's get to the bottom of this. So they offer him a cup of coffee because they want to lift his DNA, his fingerprints off of it. And if you're keeping notes, recall in the season 2 finale wrap-up show, I talked about an idea I had about the coffee test for Dale Cooper inside the lodge that he failed. He identified with the ego and drank the cup of coffee. He wasn't prepared to cross the abyss, and he failed, and that's why he was stuck in the lodge for 25 years. So now here's Dougie in whatever world this is, and he gets offered the cup of coffee again, and he fails again. After he drinks the coffee, though, he's staring at the U.S. flag, and he hears America the Beautiful playing in his head. Then he stares at a woman's red high-heeled shoes. Then he stares at an electrical outlet. Now, these are more reminders. These are more cues of Cooper's past, trying to wake Dougie up. Cooper's consciousness that's within Dougie or something, right? The U.S. stuff, he's a patriot, right? He works for the FBI. The red heels, remember in the pilot episode, Audrey wears the red heels, which is like the Wizard of Oz and Dorothy. You know, there's no place like home. She has the ruby heels. And speaking of, where's Audrey Horne? Where the hell is Audrey Horne? We're halfway through part 3, or season 3. I want my money back. And he manifested into this world through that electrical outlet. Remember that? Remember in Fire Walk with Me? Electricity. So, I like the spike. He leaves a message for someone named JT. He says, no cigar, taking medical leave. Who's JT? No idea. Probably doesn't even matter. I saw one guess on a Twin Peaks forum that thought it was Judy Tremond. Maybe. And something odd here, when you watch this part of this episode, and I'll put the image on the Instagram, at Isaac Weisop, like and subscribe. When you look in the mirror of Ike the Spike, he's on the phone, and if you look in the mirror, he's in a motel room, and behind him is another phone. And I just noticed it, right? Because I'm watching these shows very closely. That's bizarre. Have you ever seen a hotel room? A motel room, by the way, with two phones. Seems odd. Jade gives two rides. Is this a doppelganger thing? Are these doppelganger phones? Regardless, the police arrest Ike the Spike. Back in the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department, Lucy and Andy are shopping for chairs. They're debating on red or beige in the most Lynchian way possible. This is not why the episode is called This is the Chair. All right? Or is it? No, it's not. We're going to find out later. Lucy wanted the beige chair, but she ends up buying the red one because Andy wanted it, but she only really wanted him to cater to her. And boy, what a mess. Who cares? And this is the kind of stuff that most people tap out on Twin Peaks. They're like, this is stupid. Is there a meaning behind this scene? There's chairs in that in the waiting room. I don't know. Then we are taken to a home where a guy named Johnny has been let out of his room, and he's sprinting around and he bashes his head into the wall. And next to it is a photo of waterfalls, which makes me think of the Twin Peaks waterfalls at Snoqualmie. Is this Johnny guy dead? More importantly, is this Johnny Horn? I ascertain that it must be because we hear a woman yelling about how they shouldn't have let Johnny out. And, you know, remember Johnny from season one, he I'm trying to think of the right term. you know, this is the wrong with the PC thing. I don't know the right term. I want to be respectful, like mentally handicapped, right? And apparently this woman is caretaking him for him, and he shouldn't have been let out, and he got out. So I think this is Johnny Horn, which then, hey, maybe Audrey's around the corner. Then we get a scene where Hawk and Truman show up to Major Briggs's wife's home to ask about the day that Briggs died, because prior to Briggs's death, he had an interaction with Dale Cooper, which you recall was after the Dale Cooper, a.k.a. Mr. C or Bob, came out of the Black Lodge in Glastonbury Grove at the end of season two. And she says, yeah, Major Briggs, Garland Briggs, he had a conversation with Cooper. And afterwards, Briggs pulled me aside with some very specific instructions. Take a listen.
Ms. Briggs.
Ma'am.
Gentlemen.
We're here to talk to you about Agent Cooper's visit with the Major the day...
The day before Garland died.
Yes.
All right, listen to me. Right after Agent Cooper left that day, Garland pulled me aside, and he said that one day... Our son Bobby and Hawk and Sheriff Truman. I didn't know it would be the Sheriff Truman. He said that they would come and ask me about Special Agent Dale Cooper. He squeezed my shoulders when he told me this. I tried to ask him what it was about, but he wouldn't say any more. He just said, when they come to ask you about Agent Cooper, you give them this. And now you're here. Would you fellas like some coffee? Come with me.
He told Betty someday this exact event was going to happen. And when it did, she needed to give them an item that he was storing in the chair. That's why this episode is called This is the Chair. Now, recall how the Secret History of Twin Peaks book ends. It tells you what happened. It says Briggs met up with Cooper after Cooper came out of the Black Lodge, the waiting room, the red room, whatever you call it, at the end of season two. And we know that wasn't Cooper. We know that was Bob, a.k.a. Mr. C. And he freaks out and initiates the May Day protocol. All right. So Betty opens a secret hiding place on their red chair and gives them this metallic cylinder. And she literally says, this is the chair, before opening a secret compartment. So now we know why this episode has the title it does. Okay. I think. So Lucy and Andy, they were arguing over the beige or the red chair. Remember that? Lucy wanted the beige, Andy wanted the red. Why did we have that scene? I think it could be part of that female premonition, because Lucy ended up committing to the red chair, which turned out to be the same color as Betty Briggs's chair. So Betty tells Bobby how Garland always had faith that Bobby would turn out to be a good guy, and he almost starts crying. This is, again, an echo, a reverberation from the scene in season one at the Double R Diner where Bobby and Garland connect, right? So FBI shows up to Buckhorn, to the morgue, to meet Lieutenant Knox. And boy, this is major revelations here. Cole, they walk in and Cole says, the waiting room, when they walk in. Well, we know what the waiting room is. So again, you've got all these strange sort of parallels to season one and two. They're making a lot of references to it. And if you didn't pay attention, you would miss all this. Because a lot of people, I would argue, and my experience was too, the first time I saw season three, I was like, where's Twin Peaks, dude? There's no Twin Peaks in here. But it's there. Okay? It's like a parallel version of it almost. So Diane lights up a cigarette in the waiting room, and police tell her to put it out. Of course, she's a real jerk about it. So Cole and the others, they head to the body. She stays behind, but she's covertly checking her phone. And what do we see? We see the message about the dinner table being lively from Mr. C. These two are talking, okay? And we got caught up on the case. Take a listen to the breakdown of what's been going on.
Detective Mackley handled the case when it came in. He'll brief you on background.
William Hastings was having an affair with the local librarian, Ruth Davenport. Now, Davenport's head was found atop the headless body of your Major Briggs. Once we took Hastings into custody, his wife was murdered in their house, apparently by their lawyer, a man named George Bouncer, who is now also in custody. And the next day, Hastings' secretary died in a car explosion.
What happens in season two?
Apologies in advance for Albert.
So we hear William Hastings was having an affair with Ruth Davenport. That's the librarian. Hastings' wife gets killed, and they put her lawyer into custody. And then Hastings' secretary also gets killed in a car explosion. And they go to check out the torso of Major Briggs. Recall in episode one of season three, this is the one that Ruth Davenport's head was mounted to in the bedroom. And we hear something very critical to this entire show, to the entire Twin Peaks theory. Take a listen to this clip.
Well, this is your Major Briggs. It turns out that William Hastings, along with the help of Ruth the librarian, was researching and publishing some strange little blog about some alternate dimension.
This from the principal of your local high school.
Not to mention marble champion of the sixth grade.
When did he lose his marbles?
When the dog got his cat's eyes.
About 1 week ago, Hastings ended his blog entry with this cryptic sentence. Today we finally entered what we call the zone, and we met the Major. This is the body of a man in his 40s.
Yes.
Albert? Let's think out loud.
Major Briggs would have been 72. As you know, we thought he died in a fire in that government facility outside Twin Peaks 25 years ago. About the age this man is now.
Well, consider this. Cooper knew Briggs. Cooper was around Briggs 25 years ago. And now Cooper shows up in this neck of the woods.
On the loose in this neck of the woods.
Right.
And I found this in his stomach. It's inscribed. It says, "To Dougie, love, Janie E."
We need to speak with this William Hastings.
We find out that Hastings and Ruth were publishing a blog about accessing an alternate dimension. The final blog post was saying that today we finally entered the zone and met the Major. So the Mob Zone is the alternative dimension, and this is where Major Briggs met with William Hastings and Ruth Davenport. And Albert, he meets his match with the coroner. They have a little bit of flirting in this scene. But we see Briggs' torso, and it's confirmed that his torso was only about 40 years old, but he should have been 72 at this point, right? So the torso is clearly from 25 years ago. Cooper and Briggs both showed up in Buckhorn 25 years later, and they're kind of making note of this, trying to make sense of this from a Blue Rose case perspective. The coroner, the mortician, found a ring in Briggs' stomach that says, "To Dougie, love, Janie E." Recall all the history of the rings on this show. This is significant. It always is. We last saw a ring near the beginning of season 3 when Dougie went into the Red Room. Mike told him he was manufactured, remember that? And he kind of shrinks out of existence, and behind he leaves a golden orb and a jade ring. And Mike picks them up and places the ring back on the altar table. And in The Secret History of Twin Peaks and all of season 1, season 2, Fire Walk Me, there was a ton of emphasis on that jade ring. And now we have a ring, a different ring. This one was in Major Briggs' stomach, and it says, "To Dougie, love, Janie E." It doesn't seem like it's a jade ring, but it does make me wonder how Briggs got this ring and if he swallowed it as a way, just as a backup to prove his existence or his connection with Dougie. I mean, it's very confusing. The show is very confusing. They show us Jerry. He's out hallucinating in the woods. He tells his foot tells him, "I am not your foot." Parallels to season 3, episode 1, where he says, I am the evolution of the arm. You know, I am the arm. This is, I am not your foot. And we go to the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department. Lucy's on her lunch break. Chad's eating 2 microwave dinners in the conference room where he shouldn't, so Truman kicks him out, even though they eat donuts and drink coffee in there. But hey, we all hate Chad. It's fine. So they have a debate on what this item is that Briggs provided to them in the chair. It looks like a cigar tube. And Bobby tells them that, hey, I know how to open this, but we got to go outside. Even though it just took forever for them to unpack the conference room to get in there and kick Chad out and all this, then all of a sudden Bobby's like, we have to go outside. So Lucy, they're walking out. She puts her hand up. She's eating her sandwich. She puts her hand up, implying like she's on her lunch break. Don't bother her. I feel that so hard. I know what that feeling is at the dreaded day job. I'm like, can you please go to hell? or bad Santa. I'm on my lunch break. So Bobby slams it on the ground, and it starts humming. And I immediately think of the Great Northern in season 3 here, where Ben Horn keeps hearing this humming in the Great Northern. He slams it a second time, and this time they're able to pull out this piece of paper. And the shot is interesting because you can see the sawmill tower from the opening credits of season 1 and 2 next to the sheriff's department. And I don't recall them ever showing that these two were that close together before. That is actually where they're located in real life. If you go take the tour of the area of Snoqualmie, that's actually where they're located, obviously, right? But that humming is kind of a version of the electricity crackling static that we hear oftentimes, I believe. I believe it's kind of a muffled form of that static, perhaps, meaning we're losing some fidelity of the real world that we're familiar with season one, season two, Fire Walk With Me. That's what I think. I think that humming is a distant form of the electricity, and the more copies of something you make, the less fidelity that exists. So I think we are dealing with a kind of parallel Twin Peaks world. It's not quite the original. It's a little different. Now, in the note, there's talk about going to Jack Rabbit's palace with dirt in your pocket at 2:53 on October 1st and October 2nd and heading 253 yards east. Then there's two upright triangles, a red circle, a red moon, and a black lodge dog symbol, the one that Mr. C was looking for. It's all packed into this little sheet of paper. Briggs put it on there for a reason. And you can see the image I'm talking about on my Instagram. We also confirm it is now late September because Truman says, well, October 1st and 2nd, that's 2 days from now. I don't know if that helps anything, but the note to Bobby and the police also has the print from season one that remember when Briggs showed up to Cooper's room and said, hey, we tracked the space for listening for aliens and we got this message, Cooper, Cooper, Cooper. Only this paper just has two of the Coopers. It says Cooper, Cooper. And Hawk says there's two Coopers. You see, two Coopers fits season three, Mr. C and Dougie. But originally there was three, which kind of makes in season one or two. And that kind of makes more sense, right? Because you got Dougie, you got Mr. C, and you got the real Dale Cooper. Now, keep in mind, all of this is from Major Briggs, who apparently time traveled, went to the mob zone, knew something was wrong with Cooper, and started the Mayday Protocol, whatever that is. And even Sheriff Truman remarks about how Garland Briggs somehow knew all this was going to happen. Bobby said that Garland took him to a place near that station, and Bobby called it Jack Rabbit's Palace. And it's where they use their imagination, so they all say, okay, Bobby, you'll take us to Jack Rabbit's Palace on October 1st. All right. Almost done here. We go back to Buckhorn. Diane's smoking outside this time. Cole and Tammy head out and they hang out with her, and Cole takes a drag from her ciggy. He says, we used to smoke way back when, remember? And Diane says, sure do. Which is sad because David Lynch can't direct anymore because of, I believe, emphysema or something from smoking so long. They go to William Hastings, who's apparently been crying for days since he got incarcerated. I'm going to play a clip. This one's pretty long, but it's important because it talks a lot about the search for the mob zone. Take a listen.
I'm Agent Tammy Preston of the FBI.
Oh, God, the FBI.
Mr. Hastings, I'm also recording our conversation.
Okay.
Would you state your name and age for the record?
I'm William Hastings. I'm 43.
Mr. Hastings, are you the author of an online journal or blog entitled The Search for the Zone?
Yes.
What sort of things do you write about?
Different things.
Approximately 2 weeks ago, did you write an entry about encountering what you described as an alternate reality?
A different dimension. Yes, but it's real. It's all real.
How long have you been interested in this subject, Mr. Hastings?
Many years. I do a lot of reading.
But this time you wrote that you actually found and entered such a place.
Yes.
And that while in this place, you wrote, and I quote, we met the Major.
Yes. You see, Ruth was very good at uncovering hidden records. And she had indications that if we went to a certain place at a certain time, we would enter the dimension and make contact with a certain person. And so we went there.
And that's where you found the Major?
He was hiding there. Or hibernating, as he said. And other people were maybe going to find him. And he wanted to go to a different place. And so he asked us to get him numbers. Important numbers. Coordinates. And we found them in the place he told us to go, a secure military database.
Do you still have those coordinates?
No, Ruth had them. She wrote them on her hand, though, so that she wouldn't forget. Sorry.
What happened then, William?
We bought them back the numbers last Thursday. And then something terrible happened. These others came in and they grabbed me by the neck and they pushed me down. I said, "What's your wife's name? What's your wife's name?" Phyllis, I said. I didn't kill Ruth. I didn't kill her. You have to believe me. I loved her. Oh, this is all my fault. This is all my fault. It never should have happened.
William, are any of these six photographs I'm showing you the man you call the Major?
That's the Major.
Draw a circle around the photo of the man you call the Major, sign and date it.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell me what happened?
We gave him the numbers. And he started to float up. And he said some words. Cooper. Cooper. Right before his head disappeared. It was something like no one has ever seen before. I've never seen anything like it. I've never read anything like it. You don't know. You weren't there. It was beautiful. And then Ruth was dead. It was so terrible. And I had to hold her. And then I woke up and I was in my home. I was in my home.
Did the Major kill Ruth?
No, there were so many people there. You have to believe me. Please, I didn't kill Ruth. I loved her. I loved her. I don't know what is happening to me. Why can't you help me, please? Please. We were so happy together. We were gonna go to the Bahamas. We were gonna scuba dive and drink mixed drinks on the beach. And we were gonna soak up the sun. Look at the beautiful sunsets. She said to me, she said, "Bill, let's just go. Let's just do it. Let's go to the Bahamas. Let's go scuba diving." I wanna go scuba diving.
Tammy asks him about this blog, The Search for the Zone. And 2 weeks ago, he had wrote about this other dimension, which he asserts is real. He said, "I've been there." She asks about the thing saying, "We met the Major." And he says, "Ruth is good at uncovering hidden records. And one of these hidden records talked about going to a certain place at a certain time. And that's what they did. And when they went there, the Major was hibernating there, hiding from someone. And Briggs had them get certain coordinates from a secured military database, and Ruth wrote them on her hand. I think these were the coordinates that Ray was going to get from Ruth for Mr. C. All right. Why did Mr. C want them? I would guess he was looking for Major Briggs, or maybe he was looking for the mob zone himself to find a hiding place to prevent himself from having to go back into the lodge, because remember, he's trying to avoid that. So William says that when they went there, some of the people showed up and they harassed him, and he claims that he's like, look, I didn't kill Ruth. I loved her. I mean, he's kind of a mess. And Hastings says that they gave Briggs the numbers and he started to float, and he said, Cooper, Cooper, just like that paper, by the way. And then his head disappeared. Hastings says it was beautiful, which is odd. And at some point, Ruth is dead. And William had to hold her, but then he woke up in his home. And Tammy asked if the major killed Ruth, and he said he doesn't know. There were so many people there. So is Briggs dead? Who were the people all around? They apparently were not with Blue Rose, otherwise Cole would have known. I mean, this unpacks more mysteries than anything, but it's very pivotal to the whole storyline. Meanwhile, at the Great Northern, Ben and Beverly are seductively looking for that ring. My goodness. Ben suggests it's similar to a monastery bell and suggests it's otherworldly. Okay. Beverly starts to embrace Ben, and then Ben Horn, of all people, shuts it down, saying he can't do this.
With Ashley Judd?
And he says, I don't know why it is. That Civil War era really changed him. Getting socked by Dr. Hayward must have changed his whole MO, I guess. And then finally, we go to Roadhouse Diner, or the Roadhouse Bar. It's EDM night. There's two drug-addicted women hanging out. One's scratching her armpit, talking about how she's got a job serving hamburgers. And the band Avoir Simone plays during the credits with the lyrics that say, it's always just a dream. Okay. So, it's going to start heating up, folks. It's going to start heating up. And boy, it's going to end in spectacular fashion. So, continue on the journey. Twin Peaks The Return, Season 3, Part 10. And I will meet you back here in the Grey Lodge. Stay positive.